Sally, regards once again to each and all staff of NEMATA and visitors to the campus alike. This is the main professor and founder of the school, recording on the 19th of March, 2019, and that would be 6 months and a day since the inauguration of NEMATA in September of last year. Now, I'm here to present a little introductory and orientation talk on Course 5 in Metacritique. And I'm taking the measure of posting this talk on the course landing page, which is accessible to guests at the school and not exclusively to the staff. I do that from time to time when I sense that the orientation material will have a special appeal to those who are guests or visitors who are trying to find their way into the dense and rich material of the school and who might need a little bit of direction to know what's what and to get a sense of what would be valuable to pursue. So here goes. Also, I can say with some satisfaction, kind of satisfaction that acquires a certain vintage flavor over the years, like a maturing wine, I can say that this course, inauguration of this course, gives me the opportunity to tell you a little about the foundation of meta-history. Meta-critique was initially introduced as a facet of metahistory.org back in July of 2002. So there's an intimate relationship between the meta applying to history and the meta applying to critique. So perhaps I could fill you in just for a moment on exactly how those two words and all they entail fit together and complement each other. I can recall pretty clearly the moment in the fall of 2001 when the word metahistory came up in a conversation. The context of that conversation was a discussion with some individuals at the Marion Foundation in Marion, Massachusetts, now known as the Marion Institute. And the moment when that word, metahistory, came into the dialogue was during the week of November 2001, when I attended Marion to present a talk on Gnosticism as an alternative form of religion, if you will. Gnosticism and the mysteries was my theme. And on that occasion, I spoke before at the two-day event with the noted Gnostic scholar, Alain Pagels, who wrote the Gnostic Gospels. And it was through that book, the title of which is quite misleading, that Alain Pagels, who is a professor of the history of religion at Princeton University, I believe, brought the topic of Gnosticism in general and the Nag Hammadi writings in particular before the attention of the mainstream. So she should always be credited for having done that. Previous to the Gnostic Gospels, the material of the Nag Hammadi writings, although it had been translated into English by James Robinson and his team around 1976, was not really well known, or nor was it accessible. But Elaine Pagels changed all that, and I have to tell you that on the Friday night gathering before the weekend conference, I was deeply moved to meet Alain Pagels. I was shaking, actually, with a kind of excitement and gratitude, which shocked her a bit to see. So I sat and chatted with Elaine Pagels and told her what an impact the Gnostic Gospels had made on me. And at the same time, I let her know and everyone else know who was going to attend the conference that they needed to be careful not to kill the messenger. I said that because I came to that conference with a non-Christian, anti-Christian message drawn from the Gnostic writings, by contrast to Elaine Pagels, who is, in her own right and by her own definition, a devoted Christian. So there you go, that was the situation. And then after the conference, which took place only about a month and a half after the 9/11 event, after the conference, I was hanging around talking with some members of the Marian Institute. Now, I had been in association with them since I went there, I think it was in 1998, with Graham Hancock, when I also presented or introduced them to the mysteries. And so we had a relationship developing, going on about 3 years or so. And the moment came when a couple of the members proposed to me that I write a website for the Marian Foundation, as it was then called. And that is how MetaHistory came to be. Now, I remember I was talking with one of the Baldwin brothers about this prospect. Actually, they put to me the opportunity to create this website, and they sponsored it from 2002 to 2009, a period of 7 years. And I can't remember if it was one of the Baldwin brothers or myself who actually proposed the word. We were just chatting about what such a website might entail, how it would be set up, what would be the premises and objectives of such a website that I might be able to write specifically for the Marian Institute. And the word MetaHistory popped into the conversation. So there you have it. So, how did I understand MetaHistory at that time? And how did MetaHistory come to morph into the concept of metacritique, which formed an essential part of a lot of the early content of the website? As both guests to the school and staff will know, there are about 400 plus units, that would be individual electronic text, in migration from metahistory.org to Nemeta. And these texts, which are widely varied in character, are distributed into the 12 categories of the courses, as well as the three vocations: Planetary Tantra, the GNE, and Celestics. So at that moment, November of 2001, none of that writing existed. Eventually, over the period of the next 7 years, the content that I produced for the Marian Foundation and posted on MetaHistory.org amounted to, I would say, anywhere between 15 and 20 books. Some of those would have been shorter books of 75 or 80 pages. Some of them would have been books of 200 to 300 pages. And that is the content on metahistory.org, now in migration to Nemeta. And at that time, however, of course, I didn't have any idea where any this was going to take me. And also, bear in mind that 2001, November 2001, was exactly 5 years before Not in His Image was published on November 6th, 2006. Okay? So 5 years before Not in His Image, the concept MetaHistory was born. Now, what I understood it to be at the time is essentially what it still is today. And you will find that concept stated or expressed in the mission statement of the site. So let me just find that and read it to you. I would really enjoy doing that, actually. Metahistory.org charts a passage beyond the received scripts of history and culture toward a world free from enslavement to historical lies and unexamined beliefs. Humanity is a species endangered by its beliefs, and most of all, its religious illusion of superiority. To go beyond history is not solely a human prerogative, for the path ahead is not ours alone, but the way of all sentient beings. Closely aligned with deep ecology and going deeper, this site develops open-source spirituality that reflects and engages the innate sanity of the human animal. It explores the prospect of a genuine planetary outlook, a way to live bonded intimately to the Earth and co-evolving with the non-human world. Toward that end, it invites a future myth, a story to guide the species and align one person at a time to Gaia, the living planet. And this is her story. And beneath that, you find the watchword or byline for Metahistory, which I took from The Function of the Orgasm by Wilhelm Reich. Quote, "Knowledge of that which is alive can alone banish terror." End quote. So there you have it. Stands up beautifully today, if I may say so myself. And if you go to metahistory.org today, you'll find that there is still some material from the original site on display to sample, and there will and more will be added over the next few months. And there is a link. The immediate and primary link is indicated by the phrase, "And this is her story," which I just clicked on. And that takes you immediately to a version of the Fallen Goddess scenario, summary and evaluation, an immensely elaborate version of the astronomical myth of the Fallen Goddess in 9 episodes. And there it is. That's called FGS 1.0. So you see, after all is said and done, I can be fairly coherent. I have managed to preserve a certain trajectory of intention and expression over these years, a good part of my lifetime. You could say I'm a late bloomer. It's certainly been the most productive part of my lifetime since metahistory.org was launched in 2002. So the passage cited, you know, more or less tells you everything that you need to know about what metahistory is in the first paragraph. You know, a passage, it's a passage beyond. Meta is the Greek word for beyond. It's a passage beyond the received scripts of history and culture, but it's not a passage beyond history itself. What I can tell you now that I could not articulate at that time, due to the fact that I was not experiencing the correction of the Aeon Sophia as vividly and immediately as I do now, what I could not say at that time was that the passage beyond the received scripts of history and culture depends upon a clear view, a clear, accurate, and honest, factually based, verifiable view of what our history really is. Think of history as a horizon. It's an horizon, and you sight off that horizon. But if the horizon is distorted, then your sighting of the passage beyond history will be in jeopardy. You know, there's a device in photography called a pathfinder lens. And a pathfinder lens is something that you use to set up the perspective of a shot you're taking, particularly a long shot, a zoom lens shot. So I took that shot when I established metahistory.org. Metahistory means to go beyond the scripts of history, but you can only do so by having an accurate and honest knowledge of your history. I've often emphasized that the correction of the Aeon Sophia, which is a grandiose and recondite notion derived from the Nag Hammadi writings, when you see it and comprehend it existentially, that correction requires the correction of the historical record. In particular, it requires that any sane person of conscience, any sane individual who cares for a better world must correct the lies and errors regarding the history of the 20th century, the role of Germany in World War I, and the role of Germany in World War II being the central issues in that feat of historical correction. So at the time that I established Metahistory, I didn't have anything like the full comprehension that I now have of what is involved in correcting the historical record. But I set the course for that undertaking. Now, what about metacritique? Why is it metacritique rather than critique? Well, I want to say this about critique. You know, critique is another way of talking about critical thinking. Someone who has the ability to engage in critical thinking can do critique. As many of you listening to me will probably agree, one of the perils of the time we live in is that the great majority of human animals have either no talent or no capacity or neither of those two when it comes to critical thinking. So as far as I'm concerned, my friends, the ability to critique expressions of rhetoric, to critique philosophy, to critique mainstream discourse, to critique anything that is presented to you in the form of language and argument, is absolutely essential to the sanity of the human species. And if you don't have the capacity to critique what comes to your attention, you are hopelessly lost. Hopelessly lost. So I invite you to course 5 in order to learn critique. But why do I call it metacritique? Well, critique is just the application of the generic ability for critical thinking to larger subjects, such as metaphysics, religion, philosophy, belief systems, and ideologies. So, for instance, you don't really critique Islam, which, by the way, is not a religion, it is a political ideology. You do not critique Islam. You have to meta-critique Islam. See that? You do not merely critique Christianity, the belief system of Christianity. You have to meta-critique Christianity. Meta-critique applies to the action of using critique on the great subjects and the great questions and encompassing issues of human experience, not just on singular, particular, and discrete issues. You know, for instance, you can critique, for instance, the civil rights movement in the United States. You know, you can critique the premises of the civil rights movement. You can critique segregation versus integration. That's a lesser critique. But if you want to look at the great picture in which that issue is embedded, then you have to go to metacritique. So I offer you to step through that gateway with course five. Now, as I explain on the landing page, this course presents a mulligan stew of themes and topics, but there is method in the mulligan. So I draw for the units for metacritique from some of the first articles written for medhistory.org, and there's many of them, believe me, there's a lot that has been done here. But the overall material falls roughly into two categories. First, concerning the exposition of the method of metacritique, the critique of belief systems, and it sets out a toolkit for that practice. And then there's the demonstration of the method. I'll show you how to use the method. And in addition to that, I might add that there is certain background reading and study that every one who wants to practice metacritique would do well to be acquainted with. I was delighted to be able to feature on the landing page where you are accessing this talk the image of the wrathful deity or dangerous guardian that I originally associated with metacritique. It is, of course, drawn from the dubious genre of Vajrayana or Tibetan Buddhism. And I always like to, be a little scary or spooky if I can, to get your attention. They're for the better to get your attention at times. And so I present this image of this wrathful deity with a double entendre attached to it. It has a double spin. One respect, this is the deity that protects you by tearing away the beliefs that you don't need, which are really ruining your life, even though you don't know it. So it's a benevolent deity. The wrathful deities are benevolent. Think of them as occupying the white of your eye, by contrast to the colored part of your eye, which is the residence of the peaceful deities. And yet, at the same time, that image, which is frightening, intends to be frightening by evoking the emotion of fear. It signals you to the fact that belief change and divesting yourself of beliefs, or even examining beliefs with brutal clarity, can be a fearsome act. So the simple truth is, perhaps nothing scares many people more than a clear and rational challenge to what they believe. Do Muslims come to mind? This being so, the moment when values part from faith has to be an event of immense and decisive importance in the life of anyone who dares to undertake that shift. And I refer here to the series of talks which I've initiated on the Nemata YouTube channel under the playlist titled Christianity Defied. Notice it's defied, not denied. Christianity Defied. And I've introduced a meme which I intend to explore and develop extensively in this year, 2019. When values depart from faith. Now, that meme, that phrase, is actually a tool of metacritique. It is, I would say, my finest tool. It is my scalpel. So over the 17 or so years since I introduced metahistory and metacritique, I've been developing my art. And now I have in my hands the consummate tool of metacritique, which is expressed in those five words, when values part from faith. So look forward to hearing those words and seeing that phrase as a cue to bring your attention to metacritique in the coming year. So here at the half hour point, I'm going to shift my attention to the written text called Defining Metacritique. And you'll see that's posted under the section Highlights and Previews. And then in the second section of the curriculum, you find Block 101, which I've titled A Potpourri of Beliefs. And there you have some material describing to you with the many different categories of beliefs and how they work and how they operate. Perhaps you know, belief is a very loose and general term, but as a matter of fact, in action, there are very specific modes of believing. And I categorized and inventoried them and to a certain extent deconstructed them in these introductory units of Block 101. So there you go. So in coming into the home stretch here, I'm going to bring your attention to that written text, which contains a signal phrase. You could say that with this, again, five-word proposition, I really placed metacritique on the map. What is that proposition? Quote, we behave as we believe, unquote. So I introduced that phrase in 2002 as a way to begin teaching how metahistory works. So just let me review that for a moment. Just let me review that approach that I made way back then. One thing, I quoted Walter Kaufman. Now that's a Zenosh alert, as some of you know, but I did learn a lot from reading Walter Kaufman over the years. He wrote a book called The Future of the Humanities, in which he said the following, quote, Socrates was no scholastic. He was a loner who questioned the common sense of his time. Yet he did not try to spell out a vision of his own. He made a point of not being a visionary and of being, in effect, anti-scholastic. He examined the faith and morals of his time, ridiculed claims to knowledge that were based on uncritical reliance on consensus, and exerted himself to show how ignorant, confused, and credulous most people are. End quote. Now, as for the rest of that text, that unit, migrated over from metahistory, I've left it more or less as it was to be, you know, to stand as a record of my development. I could certainly modify it, revise it, and upscale the language in a number of ways, but there it stands as a record of where I was coming from then. You can compare it to where I am right now. You'll find that I refer to belief change, and there's more about belief change. In fact, there's an entire unit or essay dedicated to belief change in one of the coming blocks. And I refer to bioneers at that point, because over the years from 2002, well, later on, I guess it was, leading into 2005 and 6, the last time that I spoke in association with the Marian people, it was at a conference called Bioneers by the Bay. So you see there, I wrote, the motto of Bioneers, who collaborate with Marian Institute to offer the annual conference, Bioneers by the Bay, is connecting for change. The mix and merge of our different realities induces a sharper, more compassionate sense of our common reality. God, that was terribly kind of me, wasn't it? Beliefs that we have acquired through others can be changed by dialogue with others. but not without confronting fear and attachment, emotions that link us to unsustainable beliefs. Belief change, belief-change, is the single most revolutionary action leading to a sane and sustainable future for human life on Earth. On this site, we examine beliefs to discover what guides the human animal for better or worse. Belief change enables us to make personal and social commitments freed of blind conformity, to receive stories, imposed rules, and unexamined agendas. So let me continue, if I may. This is not bad. It is easy to think about change, but more difficult to change the way we talk and think about ourselves and our experiences in the first place. To make the shift toward more cogent and effective language, a syntax for optimal living, metahistory considers different expressions of belief found in stories of all kinds, from biblical tales to news reports. This process invites dialogue, shared explorations of our collective and personal scripts, etc. Because we all enact scripts of the six types, you'll find that in the units, often in tight combinations, familial and religious scripts combine, for instance, for many people, we are all qualified to detect how the power of stories is demonstrated in our lives and in the world at large. Beliefs inherent to science, religion, and culture, the three formats also explained in the units, can drive human behavior in blind and harmful ways. Now, metahistory assesses the hidden dynamics of motivation to determine what is insane and humane in human belief systems. I might add, pertinent to that point, which is certainly a pertinent point, there is an essay or unit in Course 5 called Insane and Inhumane. And that is a foundation essay, which will probably show up in Block 103, 104 somewhere. The point that I want to make here, in conclusion, is that, I'll read this final sentence in this paragraph. The most potent way to change behavior is to change the beliefs that drive it. But to do so, one must courageously and honestly investigate and evaluate our innermost convictions, end quote. I would also add that in order to change the beliefs that drive behavior, you need to apply metacritique to the study of narratives, stories, and myths, because beliefs are encoded in stories, and beliefs drive behavior. Now, if you can take those two phrases, those two cogent and succinct phrases on board, you have the gleaming kernel of metacritique. Beliefs drive behavior, and beliefs are encoded in stories. That's the sum and essence. That's the whole enchilada, including a very large serving of green chili from Hatch, New Mexico, and a dollop of sour cream. So, on that happy note, I invite you to stay tuned while I indulge myself in a short trip down memory lane. Now, you know, I do this from time to time. I go back and I recount certain moments in the past, in some cases, the rather remote past, when I discovered something or when I stumbled upon a clue that led over time to fruitful developments. Why do I repeat such incidents to you? Who might otherwise not be particularly entertained? Well, of course, the first factor that compels me to do so is my incurable self-importance, which only grows and bloats with age. On the other hand, you could say that I use these occasions to pull rank on you, which I certainly have, or I use these occasions to assert seniority over you, which I certainly can do. And all those things are true. All those observations and reflections are apt. Yet I would remind you of that saying from the Na Ki, which I cite in the Seeker's Handbook. One must recount the origin of the medicine, otherwise, it cannot work its magic. So now listen closely, if you can stand it. I first used to go back to Brooklyn, New York, 333 Court Street, to visit my Italian relatives on my mother's side when I was about 10 or 12 years old. And I went back on my own, actually, from Maine, from Friendship, Maine, ended up there in Brooklyn. My mother wasn't with me. I spent several weeks in the care of her brothers and sisters, my Italian relatives. And I was extremely bored and repelled by those people. And in general, I was pretty much left on my own and pretty bored with the whole scene, except I was very excited to be in Brooklyn and to be in proximity of New York City. And later on, when I made those visits in my teens, I ventured over to New York City. And that was a very big deal indeed. But I remember when I was about probably 12, I was there for a summer visit. And the Majorinos, my mother's Italian family, had a fruit and vegetable shop at 333 Court Street, and they lived in the rooms above. And it was a pretty extensive fruit and vegetable shop. You know what they look like, with stands, the angled stands outside where the fruits and vegetables are displayed, and then you could come inside, and there was a lot of good stuff in there. It smelled really wonderful. And there was a back room where they had, of course, the inventory, and there were crates and things like that where they stored things, sorted out the vegetables and the fruits for display. And then there was a back door leading out to a very dingy gray cement courtyard, where I was encouraged to go and take a hard little handball and bounce that handball against the wall. And that's how I was supposed to entertain myself, which I found dreadful being a country boy from coastal Maine. It was like being in the fucking gulag. And I remember one day I was sitting on the steps of the doorway leading to the courtyard behind the store. And there was a fruit crate there. Fruit crate, you know what that looks like, thin wood. And it had some paperback novels in it. I thought, well, that's odd. I was an avid reader even at that age. So I kind of rummaged through them. And there was one called Mondingo, which I later learned was a very, scurrilous, dubious story about interracial sexuality. I thought, oh, these are just some seedy, stupid novels. I'm not going to read any of these. And then my hand fell upon a certain novel, which is entitled Something of Value. And the author of this novel was Robert Ruark, Ruark. And I picked this novel up, and it kind of smelled. All these paperbacks were like, smelly. They had obviously been discarded in this fruit crate, but no one had thrown them away yet. So I was curious about why they were there. Obviously, they were there for me, or at least one of them was. So I looked at this novel, turned it over in my hand, and I thought, this is kind of an odd title for a novel. Especially because It seemed to be kind of an action adventure novel. And this novel was published in 1955 and was made into a Technicolor romance action movie with Rock Hudson in 1957. So I must have seen it, if it was in paperback, I must have seen it a couple of years after it came out. So I'm assuming I'm about 12 when I'm sitting there on the in the doorway of this wretched setting behind the fruit stand, pondering over this novel. Something of Value is a novel based on actual events that took place in Kenya Colony during the Mau Mau insurrection of the 1950s. And so it's a story about those kind of events in Africa, which are continuing to this day. Now, I don't know the particulars of the story, and I never saw the movie, but what really struck me then, and still strikes me today, is like the title. So it appears, and I only have learned this recently, that the title that Robert Ruark gave to this, rather than being something spectacular, because it deals with the Mau Mau insurrection, I mean, that's pretty bloody and spectacular, something rather abstract, the title was suggested to him by a saying that apparently he heard from certain African peoples of that time and of that era. And the saying goes like this, quote, "When we take away from a man his traditional way of life, his customs, his religion, we had better make certain to replace it with something of value," end quote. I just savor that for a moment. I do invite you to savor that. I savored that when I was 12 years old. And I thought, I wondered, why am I looking at this and why am I so affected by it? You know, when you're a child, there are all kinds of things that can affect you very powerfully. And at the moment that they do, you don't really know why. You can't explain to yourself why this affected you so much. But I was really gripped by this. I wasn't so interested to read the novel. I think I probably thumbed through it because I was an avid reader at the age of 12, but it was really not to my taste. I was more inclined to read cowboy stories or legends of Arthurian knights or tales of the discovery of Tutankhamun in Egypt and snippets of Egyptian mythology. I mean, it really didn't appeal to me as a romantic adventure story, which it is. But I pondered this phrase, something of value. So what I can tell you today, 60 years later, is that I still stare at the cover of that book in a certain sense, because I still concentrate, I now concentrate, excuse me, right now, here and now, I concentrate on this question. If the metacritique that I have introduced allows people to free themselves from the belief system, say, just of the Christian faith, then where is something of value that I can offer them to replace it? See my question? So that question resonates for me today, going back to that signal moment behind the fruit and vegetable store at 333 Court Street in Brooklyn. And I invite you to let it resonate with you as well. You know that with the code word or meme, Christianity Defied, I am going for the throat of that belief system, as if I hadn't done it already, right? I'm going to finish them off. I mean, really finish them off. But I'm not going to do it without providing them with something of value to replace the faith that they leave behind on the rugged trail of history. It's a trail where you track yourself by the traces of blood on the tracks. There is blood on the tracks of the trail of history. Not just any blood, not just the blood of the human species, not the blood of humanity, no. It's the blood of certain races, of a certain creed, of a certain code, of a certain courage. And now that blood on the tracks of history leads to the horizon of metahistory and beyond, even beyond.